no issue confronting American society more needs the kind of open discussion that I hope we will have this evening than the realities of the Israel-Palestine conflict and how it has distorted the American reality. There is an important price that is more than the monetary price tag. There's a moral and a political price tag that has been associated with allowing such an oppressive structure to be subsidized and to be complicit through such a long period of time in the subjugation of a people deprived of its lands and deprived of its rights. I wanted to say at the outset that my approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict does not proceed very much from a religious identity or on the basis of my national identity, but it really is an expression of my human identity. And I think if we want to live on this planet successfully, we have to more and more think as humans, not as Americans, not as Jews or Christians or Muslims. We have to retain those, the pride of those identities, but they have to be part of a human experience. And the more that we allow ourselves to be human, the more likely we are to take suffering seriously. And when we take suffering seriously, we become inevitably committed to the struggle for justice. And I really think that's what this whole set of issues in the end is about. And Reverend Lang referred to the importance of courage and compassion. And I think that also is really part of what is involved here. Not, I would say, less courage, although the hostility to truth-seeking in this area sometimes requires at least stubbornness, if not courage. But what I really think it demands of all of us is responsibility. Being taking seriously our sense of freedom and opportunity as citizens to engage as we can in trying to solve a situation that has been so productive of violence and suffering and injustice. And so I would say responsibility and compassion are what guides my understanding of these issues. And the compassion is something very fundamental in our historical space, I believe, because living in a more and more crowded planet that is fragile and exquisitely complex, we need more and more to be able to think, feel, and act as if the other is not an object but a subject. We have to find ways to have sympathy with the circumstances of the other. And if we allow ourselves to do that, suffering does become intolerable. And in a way, I think, what seeking the truth leads us to do is to bring us into contact, if we allow ourselves, with the suffering and therefore to recognize that it is intolerable to live passively in the presence of such a condition. We meet tonight, June 8th, on the 45th anniversary of the Israeli attack on the American espionage vessel, the USS Liberty, at which 34 American service people and over 100, 34 were killed and over 100 wounded. And this happened a long time ago, but it illustrates for me the fundamental distortion of our sense of reality that has been fostered by this disturbing relationship between our government and the government of Israel. Because this attack on the USS Liberty was a deliberate attack by the Israeli government. It's been well confirmed, including by former CIA operatives, Stephen Green, among others. And the reason for the attack was that this ship was listening to the messages between Tel Aviv and the Israeli forces on the Egyptian border. And the Israeli leadership, particularly the military commander, Moshe Dayan, at the time, didn't want the U.S. to hear the Israeli plan to attack Syria and occupy the Golan Heights. And the U.S. at that time was very nervous about doing anything in Syria because that could easily draw the Soviet Union into the conflict and escalate the situation in ways that were potentially extremely dangerous. So there was a motive for attacking the USS Liberty. And what is, I think, really extraordinary about this is that Israel, the supposed close ally, would conduct such an attack. The ship was well marked and in international waters. But what is more, I think, more revealing and more disturbing is that the American government would suppress the reality of what happened and engage in a cover-up all these years that was originally ordered by Lyndon Johnson, the president at the time. And even then, 45 years ago, the U.S. government was more willing to allow this criminal sacrifice of its own people than to tell the truth of what happened and why, apparently because Johnson was worried about a domestic Jewish backlash that would result if Israel was blamed for the attack. But what I really think is important about this is the degree to which we need, as citizens and as human beings, to pursue the truth. And we cannot rely on our government, unfortunately, to transmit the truth, even in such a situation where Americans serving as naval officers and seamen were the deliberate objects of lethal attack. I think we should all think about what does that tell us? What does that incident tell us about this whole relationship? The other anniversary is the which overlaps with what happened to the Liberty, was the Six-Day War, the June War in 1967, which again was presented to all of us, including myself, I must admit, as a war in which Israel had no choice but to defend itself against the prospect of aggression. It's only now that we are beginning to get ripples of the reality. There was an important article by the son of the one of the leading Israeli generals at the time, Miko Peled, who wrote and surprisingly was published in the Los Angeles Times, and many of you may have seen this article, in which he recounts on the basis of very reliable documentation that Israel was not did not perceive a threat in 1967, and that they understood that there was no way that the Arab neighbors could attack them with any effect. But what they did see was an opportunity for expansionism, and they saw an opportunity to destroy the military capabilities of their Arab neighbors. And so what was presented, again, with the complicity of our government, because the intelligence was available to it, was a complete false conception. A war of aggression was portrayed as a war of necessary self-defense, that Israel's survival was at stake. And again, what this is very disturbing on a number of levels, but in a certain sense, at the most fundamental level, because it illustrates that even in these most vital issues of war and peace, one cannot trust our own popularly elected government to tell its own citizens the truth. In situations where people are dying and being killed, one would have hoped that that kind of cover-up and dishonesty would be a form of treason that is regarded as a crime against the people. But we tolerate, almost we legitimize, lying by the state for whatever strategic or domestic priorities it may have at a particular time. But it tells us that we have to depend on our own capacities to find the truth and pursue the truth without accepting public manipulations of a sensitive and controversial political reality. Now, against that kind of preliminary remarks, I would call attention to three areas of falsehood or myth that explain in part the rationale for this extraordinary relationship between the United States and Israel that is almost unique in the history of international relations, particularly the degree to which the much smaller and weaker partner country is able to manipulate the superpower. The superpower has relinquished its own capability to offer criticism, however justified it may be from the point of view of American national interests. Do you realize how radical a posture that is? That a government is, whichever party is in power, is intimidated or inhibited from expressing its own understanding of the national interests involved, because it doesn't want to offend the pro-Israeli media, Congress, certain public opinion, sectors of public opinion. And nothing illustrates this intimidation more vividly, I think, than the way in which the Iran war is being, that this build-up toward a confrontation with Iran, the threats that have been posed by Israel continuously and by the United States less vigorously, have proceeded despite the widespread understanding that to carry out these threats would be disastrous economically, politically in the region, and likely have very adverse military repercussions. And my point is not to make that substantive argument so much as to say our elected leaders can't even put that before the people as a issue. They have, in fact, as some who followed this question may have learned, all 16 American intelligence agencies are agreed that the overwhelming evidence points to Iran's abandonment of a program to acquire nuclear weapons back in 2003. Now, if you listen to our leaders or read the media, you would never know this. You would never know that that there was any ambiguity about what Iran is doing, and what it's doing is exactly the opposite of what all these intelligence capabilities that we pay billions of dollars to have are informing us about. One would have expected at least that President Obama would say, in talking about the issues involving Iran, that there was some doubt about whether they were pursuing nuclear weapons. But we've proceeded not only to threaten them, but to impose sanctions. And we've done all this without even mentioning Israel's nuclear weapons arsenal. Now, why is that serious? It's serious because it conveys this what I would call geopolitical hypocrisy, that they're one set of rules for our friends and another for our adversaries or enemies. And this undermines the rule of law, because you can't have a system of law in which equals are treated unequally. It's not law then, it's power. And hard power, because it's military. And what is deeply troubling beyond what I've already said is that there's a perfectly attractive alternative to this kind of war diplomacy. And that is to establish a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East that would include Israel. Nothing could be better, actually, for the security of Israel, among other things, than to get rid of these weapons and their threat. And all of the governments in the region would be grateful for initiatives of this sort that would denuclearize, that would denuclearize the region and avoid what almost any objective observer realizes would be a disastrous encounter that is already generating acute tensions in the region and destabilizing what is already very unstable. But my point that is part of my wider effort to convey an understanding of the Israel-Palestine conflict is that because Israel is intent on this threat diplomacy directed at Iran, the U.S. leadership cannot even mention the fact that there exists an alternative to a military approach. Even a coercive sanctions approach is basically trying to force a solution, where there's a much better way that's quite obvious to handle issues of this kind. So there are two problems here that are both, in my view, fundamental. One problem is the inability, the political unwillingness of our elected leadership to criticize Israeli approaches to problems, even when we know they're wrong. And you realize how radical that is, what I'm saying. Even when we know they're wrong, we can't, at least in public, our leaders are unwilling to voice criticism. And the other point that I think is equally serious is that Israel and the United States, more than any other important governments in the world, have reduced their understanding of security to a reliance on military options. They see security through an optic that is biasing policy toward military approaches that have been proven to be, among other things, unsuccessful over and over again. See, one of the unlearned lessons of the post-colonial world is that the stronger military side usually, over time, loses the conflict. That was the main lesson of the Vietnam War, or should have been. The U.S. had complete military superiority in the air, on sea, and land. Lyndon Johnson referred to Vietnam as a tenth-rate Asian power that couldn't stand up. Yet they won the war. And we haven't been willing to learn that lesson. So we keep reinventing technology and doctrines to say next time we can win. And the most recent next times have been Iraq and Afghanistan, and only the most befuddled observer would call those victories. In other words, our leadership and our media have great difficulty thinking outside the military box. And therefore, they don't see these peaceful alternatives. Their political imagination is blinkered in such a way as to incline the response to situations of conflict, to select military instruments, no matter how dysfunctional they may be. See, and that's a very disturbing conclusion, if it is a correct commentary on how our leadership approaches these issues. Let me somewhat belatedly come directly to the some of the ideological infrastructure of this unconditionally pro-Israeli approach that is taken by our government. And I think there are three main, what one might call myths, that are widely believed, but are essentially misleading. The first is that the Jewish people, having endured the Holocaust, have long been persecuted, and that only when Jews act from strength can they find security in a world that remains essentially anti-Semitic. And beside that, in addition to that sense of permanent victimization, is the coupled belief that the only political language that the Arab world understands is the language of force. So it is that complementary set of ideas when Jews were weak and acted weakly, they were persecuted. When they are strong and use their power aggressively, they are respected and they are treated as valuable. And I think that set of ideas is very, in an exaggerated form, is expressed by Israel's current leadership, particularly Netanyahu and Lieberman. In a recent essay in the New York Review of Books, David Shulman, who's an Israeli peace activist, was reviewing a recent book, The Crisis of Zionism, and he put this issue this way. I'm quoting David Shulman. He said, like many Israelis, he, Netanyahu, inhabit a world where evil forces are always just about to annihilate the Jews, who must strike back in daring and heroic ways to establish, to snatch their life from the jaws of death. I think that like many other Israelis, he is in love with such a world and would reinvent it even if there was no serious threat from outside. And I think that sense of kind of political paranoia coupled with this stereotyping of the Arab adversary that is violent unless faced with greater violence explains a lot about the mentality that has emerged in Israel. And what's wrong with it is that it undervalues the relevance of peaceful diplomacy of the sort I just mentioned in relation to Iran. It it becomes unduly distrustful of genuine efforts to achieve peace by compromise and normalization, and it discredits thinking that does move in a political zone that is not dominated by militarist analysis and understanding. So I think there are many things wrong with that, and it leads to this willingness of the United States over the years to subsidize such a worldview that is excessively militarist and has made made the relationship with Israel unnecessarily costly over the years in a number of different ways. And as Peter Beinart argues in his important recent book, The Crisis of Zionism, and he is himself a ardent Zionist, but what he says is we need a new American Jewish story built around this basic truth. We are not history's permanent victims. It's a choice to be a victim in this world situation that now confronts Israel. It's not in any sense a destiny or a necessity. A second widely endorsed explanation of this special American relationship is that Israel is the only democracy in the region, which you hear, you don't often hear this welcome laughter, but you often hear this intoned at with great solemnity by our august leaders. But there at least several things wrong with such a generalization. At least since the Arab Spring of 2011, there are, it's no longer accurate to not recognize that Tunisia and Egypt at least have become fledgling democracies that are operating within a constitutional framework. They have problems, but they are definitely moving toward establishing democracies after engaging in largely peaceful revolutionary movements. And then even before the Arab Spring, Turkey had very much established a successful democratic governing system that was also economically extremely robust and pursuing a foreign policy that has made the Turkish leader by far the most respected political leader in the world. And Turkey is the most admired country outside of the Western world. So it's been a it's a kind of and it no longer, if it ever fit the facts, it certainly no longer fits the reality that Israel is the only democratic country in the region. And if you take a more knowing you take a position that is more in touch with the circumstances of Israel, you would realize that Israel in many respects doesn't deserve to be called a democratic country. Not only is it not the only one, it may be not one. And there are at least 26 separate laws in Israel that discriminate against the Palestinian minority living there, which is 1.5 million people, or 20% of the total population. So that it's a very serious thing to claim, to again paper over the reality. The Palestinians are at best second-class citizens, and in many ways live with increasing vulnerability and under in an atmosphere where they're not really wanted in a state that is proclaiming itself to be dedicated to the purification, ethnic purification of the population, to make it as Jewish as possible. Then, so you have this discrimination, but you also have the consistent defiance of international law. And one of the characteristics of a democratic society in the 21st century is respect for international law and international institutions. Israel rejected, without any reason, giving any reasons, a nearly unanimous decision of the International Court of Justice in 2004, declaring that the separation wall built on Palestinian occupied territory was unlawful, should be dismantled, and Palestinians compensated. It's very rare that you get a 14-1 decision in the International Court of Justice, because the judges come from all over the world. So this was a clear legal case. This was not a case that was ambiguous. And you can guess who the one judge was, what country the one judge came from. I don't need to tell you that. But what was interesting, again, from the picture of how this bias has crept into all corners of our public life, the U.S. government rejected the International Court of Justice's opinion even before Israel did. It was so eager to show that it was more pro-Israeli, and did the same thing essentially with the Goldstone report on the Gaza War of 2008-2009. It was, again, a very balanced report that identified what practices Israel engaged in that were inconsistent with international law, and from my perspective was quite pro-Israeli in overlooking some very important Palestinian issues, such as the fact that the population of Gaza was locked into the combat zone during the war, which is very unusual. Palestinians couldn't become refugees. They weren't allowed to leave the combat zone. And that, as I say, that's both very cruel and very harmful to the civilian population. Then the attack on the Mavi Marmara in May of 2010, in which naval commandos attacked a humanitarian ship that was trying to bring medical supplies to Gaza that were very, very much needed, and was trying to challenge a blockade that was a form of collective punishment that is itself a crime against humanity, prohibited by Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So in a way, this defiance of international law and the support that the U.S. has consistently given to that defiance is one further expression of the degree to which our own foreign policy cannot fulfill its own ideals because of our willingness to exempt Israel from criticism, despite the fact that we give Israel so much military and economic assistance. The third of these myths that I wanted to bring to our attention is the kind of hard power myth that Israel is the most reliable and important strategic ally possessed by the United States in the Middle East, which is so crucial because of the energy reserves. In my view, this is a complete misunderstanding of how positive relations with the region could be established if we pursued a balanced approach to the conflict and exerted pressure on Israel to solve the conflict in conformity with respect for the rights of the Palestinians under international law and the conditions for a sustainable peace. In other words, this idea that Israel is so important as a strategic ally is another misinterpretation, it seems to me, of security in the 21st century, because it identifies security with military superiority. There's no question that Israel is the strongest military power in the region, and that is a addition to American military power. But the misunderstanding is the thought that security can be achieved by reliance on military superiority. That was true, more or less, in the 19th century. And it was true before the anti-colonial movement succeeded. But it isn't true in the world as it's constituted today. And that's why military superiority has generally not produced favorable political outcomes in the major conflicts of the last 75 years. It can destroy unlimited amounts of physical structures and kill people, but it can't control the political outcome. That's not how history is moving in the 21st century. And as long as we try to fight that movement by continuing to emphasize the military foundations of security, we will find ourselves more and more vulnerable. The United States has never been stronger in its history relative to the rest of the world from a military perspective, yet we've never been more insecure. And it's this disjunction that we haven't grasped politically, and therefore we haven't acted in a rational fashion, in a sense. And again, the approach to Iran is emblematic of that failure to understand both the limits of military superiority and the alternatives to it. See, both things are important, in my view, and neither are understood. What I'm trying above all to express is that the relationship with Israel has reinforced a separate militarist turn in our own country that derives from having a permanent war economy that came after World War II and was persisted during the long Cold War. And that built up this bureaucracy, this military bureaucracy, what Eisenhower 50 years ago warned about the military-industrial complex. But that notion of a government that has become bureaucratized and in a way that is biased toward military approaches really is inconsistent with democratic government, because it creates this constant sense of threat and need to encroach upon freedoms at home. And the post 9/11 period has been dramatically illustrative of that. But what I'm trying to convey is that there is a mentality that has emerged out of this long process of militarization that has been crippling to our political and moral imaginations. And it disables us from pursuing a rational and moral course that is compatible with the particular challenges of this new century. And the relationship with Israel is, in a sense, the extreme expression of this distortion, but it is also a microcosm of a much broader problem that makes it so difficult for the country at this stage to find appropriate solutions for problems at home and abroad. I want to just say, before bringing my remarks to an end, that there are several important developments in relation to the Palestinian conflict that should be noticed by people such as yourselves who care about these issues, but also remind us that our understanding of this conflict is filtered through an extremely biased media and an extremely one-sided government, so that we don't get the opportunity to think for ourselves about what's happening in this conflict. And in a way, the developments that I wanted to just mention very briefly are illustrative of this. The first of these is the almost total disillusionment with international negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority as a constructive approach to conflict resolution. And that disillusionment, for different reasons, is on both sides, both the Palestinian side and the Israeli side. And what is, I think, important to notice is that time is not neutral. The Israelis have use the failed negotiations ever since 1993, the so-called Oslo framework, to gradually annex significant portions of the West Bank and to change the demographic balance in East Jerusalem. In other words, the Palestinians have lost and the Israelis have gained by the absence of progress in these negotiations. And Therefore, it seems like a fool's errand to continue to participate in such a game from the Palestinian side. And their most respected political leader, Marwan Barghouti, recently made a call from his prison cell to what he said, give up the farce of the peace process and negotiations and resort to massive nonviolent resistance. And the second development that both follows from and is was really anticipated prior to what Barghouti had to say, is there's been a dramatic turn on the part of Palestinian activists, including the more radical elements such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad, toward nonviolence. And again, what I would emphasize is you'd have to be a reader of online marginal publications to have any awareness of this trend. It's not only that for years now the Palestinians have essentially given up armed resistance. They have retaliated at times when Israel has attacked or assassinated some of their leaders. They've sort of symbolically attacked. But their basic political strategy, as evidenced in the how they've tried to resist, for instance, the construction of this unlawful separation wall for years, is through peaceful demonstrations that have been carried on courageously over every week for 7 years and enduring quite a bit of Israeli violence that has produced death and injury. They've tried to break the blockade of Gaza by this Free Gaza movement that is essentially a civil society initiative that seeks peacefully to challenge an unlawful regime of blockade that governments and the UN have not been able to do anything about. And they've initiated the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which is growing in strength and global reach and has had a increasing tangible effect. And most perhaps impressively of all, they've challenged the abuse of imprisonment and administrative detention by prolonged hunger strikes that are completely unreported in the American media. We hear endlessly about Chinese human rights activists or about those that challenge the situation in Tibet, and we should hear about them. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't. But these hunger strikes that currently there's one Palestinian who's a soccer star that's been on a hunger strike for 82 days, which is 16 days longer than Bobby Sands' famous IRA hunger strike back in 1981. And there's a complete blackout in the media. The IRA hunger strike back in 1981 was covered on a daily basis. See, in this part of what the media bias involves is a double movement. It's a politics of invisibility so far as Palestinian initiatives are concerned and Palestinian grievances are concerned, and a politics of magnification as soon as the Palestinians do anything wrong. So it creates a unreal appreciation of what the circumstances, the existing circumstances are. Albert Einstein said many bright things, but one of them that he said was, unthinking respect for authority is the greatest enemy of truth. And I think that we need to avoid that deference to authority to overcome the weight of conventional thinking on these issues, to get around the distortions of government policy, and to do something to correct for the biased media filter that gives us such a selective presentation of the facts that are occurring. And if you ask, what is truth in this situation, I think it is getting to understand the experience and the facts as accurately as possible, with as little interference from biased sources as can be achieved. And so I think we're all challenged, but I feel that the Palestinian people have great courage, and they do need courage, and have expressed that courage, and we need to strengthen our compassionate attachment to their struggle. Thank you very much.